I'm Georgie Crawford. This is the Good Glow Podcast. We all have a story, and I believe by telling these stories, we can inspire and empower each other on our self-care journey. This season, I've teamed up with ReproMed, Ireland's leading fertility clinics. Having been through IVF myself, I understand how daunting a fertility journey can be. I'm proud to partner with ReproMed, whose world-class team offer the expertise, empathy, and compassionate care needed to help and support you. With clinics in Galway, Dublin, Cork, Drogheda, and Kilkenny, they are never too far away and will do everything possible to help you grow your family. Visit ReproMed.ie for more. And now their sister clinic, ReproScan.ie, is available for early pregnancy and gender scanning. Hello and welcome to the Good Glow Podcast. I am speaking to you from New York City, where we are about to run the New York Half Marathon. We are so excited for this experience. I can't believe I've gone from tearing my MCL at Christmas to finally getting to New York to do this. And I am so ready for this experience. And I promise to take you along on the journey over on my Instagram at Georgie.Crawford. Busy week this week. Not only were we getting ready to come to New York, but we were also in the National Concert Hall, where we are putting the final touches to our show on May 30th. We are so excited to bring this brand new show to you. We have so much planned on the night, talks, interviews, music. And as I've been saying, this show is all about connection, love. We're going to take you on a journey, and we really want you to let go and just really enjoy this night. I've been hearing from so many people who are coming with the girls or even coming alone. People are bringing their partners, and there's lots of people bringing their mum for Mother's Day, which is so lovely, and I can't wait to see you all on the night. So if you'd like to join us on May 30th, head over to nch.ie for tickets. Now on to Louise McSharry, who is going to tell us an incredibly special story on the Good Glow Podcast this week. When I picked up the phone and asked her if I could interview her, I had no idea which way this interview would go. I didn't know if we would, you know, talk about her departure from 2FM or speak about her childhood. And Louise decided to tell me the story of her mum and growing up with her mum in Chicago, going to live with her aunt and uncle. Her mum was an alcoholic, but her mum turned her life around, and Louise speaks about their incredible relationship that was so full of love. It's an emotional one, but I know that you're going to get so much from it. So I hope you enjoy. Louise McSharry, thank you so much for joining me on the Good Glow Podcast today. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you. Delighted to be here.
I have to say, when I reached out to you, I went to look for the message today. It was on the 30th of October, and I was so nervous to send that message. I don't know why. Our paths hadn't really crossed before. I followed you, obviously, on Instagram and Twitter. I didn't even know if you knew who I was. So I was really nervous to reach out, and I said to you, I'd love you to come on The Good Glow. If you're thinking of starting a podcast, it's the perfect place to talk about a new venture. And thankfully you wrote back.
Yeah, that's so funny that you say that, because you're a mess. I mean, first of all, obviously I knew who you were and I knew what you were doing, and you know, we have lots of similarities in our backstory. So yeah, no, I was totally aware of who you were. But also I was so grateful for that message, because I was getting like a lot of messages at that time from people, because I had just lost my job in 2FM. But yours was so constructive. It wasn't just like, I got a lot of really nice messages and I really appreciated them, of people, you know, empathizing and like being really kind. But you were like, this is something that I can do that might be helpful to you if you're starting something new. And it just felt very generous to me, and I really, really appreciated it. I actually mentioned it to loads of people. I was like, I got a message from Georgie Crawford, and like, she doesn't even know me. So it's so funny to hear that you were nervous, because I was so, so grateful to receive it.
Oh, I'm so glad. And I think it was really a lesson for me in, you know, reach out and do something, or at least try to do something for someone, because I think, you know, Ireland is so small, and I think we can really support each other, especially as women in this industry. Yeah. I think it's really important for us to have each other's back.
I totally agree. Yeah, like I couldn't agree more. I think, and that thing of like asking yourself what you can do, sometimes you feel like, oh, is that even worth mentioning? Like, it's such a small thing, but actually the small things can be seismic for other people, or even just the expression of like, you know, a desire to support someone in a constructive way, I think is massive.
Yeah, because I think we can really quickly say, oh, I better leave them. I don't want them to take anything the wrong way. But actually reaching out means so much to someone, I think, when they're going through a tough time. Tell us a little bit about the last couple of months, because you have said that, you know, it's been rough. I think, Louise, you've always spoken from your heart. You've always given us the truth. Is that hard for you at times to, you know, we all sometimes want to hide away, but you really kind of faced the public head on over the last couple of months?
I honestly don't know any other way to be. I kind of can't help but be honest and share how I'm feeling about things and share my experiences about things. Now, I do like edit myself a little bit more than I used to, because we all know what living publicly on social media is like. I think even if you're not doing it yourself, you've seen the impact that it can have on other people's lives. You know, people are not always kind, unfortunately, so you have to be careful with yourself. But at the same time, my instinct is always to be honest. And it's for me, it's a fight to kind of keep the words in my mouth as opposed to kind of, you know, struggling to get them out. So, you know, I really felt very strongly about being completely honest about what I was experiencing with 2FM, because first of all, like, everybody goes through difficult career patches. We all have times in our lives where we feel, you know, like things haven't gone the way that we want them to. And just because mine was 2FM doesn't mean that someone can't take something from that. And I really, really genuinely, and obviously this is what your podcast is all about, I really feel like our personal experiences are so powerful when we share them, because nothing we go through is unique. So if you can share, if you feel capable of doing that and it's not going to be damaging to you, I think it's really valuable to do so. So I didn't even think about it. It was just like, yeah, I couldn't, to be honest, I couldn't be as honest as I wanted to be from the get-go, because I was still under contract until January. So, and I was reminded of that very clearly around the time that I was told I wasn't going to be on air anymore. So I had to be a little bit careful on that front. But when the time came that I could be completely honest, I was really ready to. Sorry, that's a very long answer.
No, I loved it. I'm here for the long answers. It means that I don't have to do as much work. Tell us about the last couple of months then. Do you feel like, you know, Brian Penny, I don't know if you follow Brian, but he speaks about like sometimes we're at 15,000 feet, sometimes we're at 3,000 feet, sometimes we're on the ground. And it's really helped me over the last couple of months realize that, yeah, when I'm at 3,000 feet or I'm close to the ground, it doesn't mean that I can't get back to 15,000 feet.
Yeah.
Have you felt, you know, coming into spring, you know, with the restrictions lifting, you're starting your podcast, do you feel a little bit of kind of hope back in your heart?
Yeah, I have to be honest. I have always felt that. Not always, but always since this last thing that I've been experiencing. Like, I have felt angry. I have felt disappointed. I felt let down. I felt embarrassed at times, but I never doubted that there was something great around the corner for me. But that's only because I'm 39 years old and this is not my first rodeo and I've been down before, you know? And I actually kept thinking about a friend of mine when I was in my 20s, like I think I was like 25, maybe 26. I had lost another radio job very abruptly. I was doing the breakfast show on iRadio and during the big crash and they had to let a load of people go. And I was one of the people that they let go and I was devastated. Like, I didn't get out of bed for a year. But during that time, I had a housemate who was a little bit older than me. And she had this quote, I think it was like Mick Jagger or someone who had said, if you knew what was around the corner for you, you would not be able to sleep. You'd be so excited. And that has just stayed this entire time. That's been in my head, that idea that, like, you know, I felt like there was something great about to happen. And at the moment I feel great because it's finally happening. But I never doubted that, because I just know from experience that's how things go.
Yeah. And I think it is such an amazing way to think. And I think Gabby Bernstein speaks about that all the time, is like trusting the universe, trust your path. And yeah. I really feel like when I'm in the depths of something really bad happening. So, you know, we were supposed to do an embryo transfer in Ukraine on the 21st of February. And just, I felt so disappointed and just heartbroken over the last while. But, you know, like you say, when you've been through a number of tough times, to really trust that you're being brought on a detour. And I know that one day I'll hold a baby in my arms, hopefully, and say, oh God, you know, if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't have this baby. Yeah. Or, you know, the way you try to tell yourself these things to get through it. For you to speak honestly from your heart is just so relatable for people.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's really important. And I have really admired, you know, the way that you've been sharing your experience of what, you know, at, I was heartbroken for you when you said that you decided to delay. But obviously, I mean, that was the right call, I feel like, based on everything I'm reading. But I can only imagine the ups and downs and the kind of agonizing that you must have been going through on that front. But because you're being honest about it, I'm sure there are other people who feel less alone. And also, I think it gives people permission to support you in a way that maybe you wouldn't otherwise. Like if we aren't honest about when we're having a tough time or when we're struggling, then how do our friends or our family or whoever it is that supports you in your life, how do they know that you need them? They don't. And then you're alone, and that's not good. And, you know, I think it's great if you can be honest about your feelings, because then people can support you. And I personally, I love nothing more than having the opportunity to support a friend through a hard time. And I know sometimes people feel like it's a burden, but I really don't see it that way. You know, if a friend of mine is going through something tough and they choose to share it with me, that I'm honored that they feel comfortable enough to share it with me, and that I then have a chance to support them in a way that they have either supported me before or that they'll probably support me in the future. And so I just think, honesty about our feelings is probably the most valuable thing we have. And like historically, we probably haven't been great at that as Irish people. But I love that we're kind of turning a corner there.
Before we came on air today, I was telling you that I was listening to an interview that you did on a podcast. I couldn't remember which podcast it was, but I remember the feeling I had. So I was in Cabinteelia, I was outside a coffee shop, and I was literally glued to my seat. I couldn't leave. Because I wanted to hear right till the end what you were talking about. And you were talking about your life in America and, you know, the ups and downs, you know, everything that you faced, which was so difficult. But can you tell us a little bit about your life in America, if you're comfortable with that?
Yeah, of course. So I suppose earlier when I said, like, I'm 39 and I've been through it, and that's why I know everything's going to be okay. I really have been through it. So I was born in Dublin. My dad died of cancer when I was 3. And then just before I turned 7, my mom announced that we were going to move to America. And my mom was an alcoholic and had been drinking, I think always. Like, definitely my dad knew before he died that there was a problem there. But I think after he died, it obviously got worse, you know, for lots of different reasons. And she was under a lot of pressure from family members, neighbors, everybody. There'd been interventions, and it wasn't happening at that time. So she decided we're going to move to America. So we moved to America.
Why did she decide that, Louise?
I mean, this is speculation, but in fairness, she did say this to me eventually, like when I was an adult, that, you know, she really just needed to be left alone so she could drink in peace. That was where she was in her addiction. And I think obviously, like, you know, new start, she was so young and her husband died and she had 2 kids. You know, my brother was only 1.5. Like, that's a lot, you know, so I don't blame her for wanting a new life. She had been a nurse. And she hadn't been working after my dad's death. So her plan was that we would go to LA and she would get her nursing certificate or whatever she needed to be a nurse in LA, and we would have a new life. But we stopped in Chicago on the way because her two brothers lived in Chicago, and we ended up not leaving. My uncle convinced her that it probably was a bad idea for us to go on our own to LA, where we didn't know each other and or know anybody, and thank God for that. So we stayed in Chicago, and we moved over in November, and on the 4th of May, she surrendered custody of us to my aunt and uncle. Things had really deteriorated in that time, and we were just not in a safe situation. She wasn't able to take care of us, and we had kind of disappeared. So the school that we were going to, the principal, Mr. Dibley was his name, I'll never forget it, and my uncle together got in touch with Child and Family Services, and they found us, basically, and then we went to live with my aunt and uncle and never moved out.
Wow, I didn't realize that the time was so short that you had with your mom over there. And where did you live?
We lived initially in an apartment, and then she made friends with the people in the apartment downstairs from us, who, and I think they were probably fine, but through them she met some people who weren't great. I mean, I'm sure they were good people, but they were also people who were dealing with addiction and other kind of, you know, traumas. So she kind of fell in with them. So then for a while we were living in a house with a lot of other addicts. I'm not really sure what the situation was there. And then we moved in with her boyfriend, who lived in a caravan. So we were there probably not for that long, but like certainly a few weeks. But those times are super vivid in my memory. I was 7 at that stage. And it was, yeah, it was rough because, like, you know, I had gone from being like first grandchild on both sides of my family, absolutely doted on, you know, amazing grandparents, amazing aunts and uncles. You know, obviously my dad died, so we were even more precious, I think, to his parents. And we spent every Sunday with them. And you know, I was always beautifully dressed, and like I had long blonde hair. I was a little princess, and I mean that in a derogatory fashion too. I think I was spoiled rotten. But to go from that to the way that we were living was pretty abrupt and dramatic. And I, on top of everything else, I felt really ashamed. And like that sounds kind of classist, and it is, because I was 7 and that's how I saw things. I was a little princess, and there are lots of people who live lovely lives in caravans and trailers, but this was not one of those. You know, my mom was drinking, he was drinking, he got arrested one day when we were out in the car. Like I wet the bed every night, and it wasn't cleaned. Like we didn't have food. It was bad.
And what sort of, did your mum change when she drank? Was she more outgoing, or was she angry, or?
She wasn't angry. No, she was just drunk. she was just like, you know, silly. She also had bipolar disorder, which wasn't diagnosed until like decades later. But it was funny. I don't know if you watched Eeyore, but there was a storyline in Eeyore where one of the main characters, Abby, her mom had bipolar disorder. And I was watching it as a teenager. And at that point, we had a long period where we weren't in contact at all. We weren't in contact with her at all at that stage. But I was like, that's so weird. She's acting just like an alcoholic, the mother. And it was only when we got back in touch with my mom that I realized, oh no, I recognized the behaviors and the mania and stuff, because that's what I was experiencing with her. We just didn't know at the time. So she would have gotten really, really excited, and we might have gone and bought like 20 toys, and you know, she'd be like, we're moving, ring the airport, like everything's amazing. And then like there was one time I was actually on the way to Chicago, we were going to stop in London, and she and I had taken a trip to London probably the year before, and it had been really successful, like a really good trip. And she was like, we're stopping in London on the way to America, and I'm going to take you to Hamleys, and you can buy all the toys that you want, and we're going to do this and we're going to do that and blah blah blah. And we got there and she was obviously in a big crash, and we just stayed in the hotel room for 4 days, and she drank Blue Smirnoff, I'll never forget it, for 4 days. And my uncle, my godfather, was living in England at the time, and he was really young at that time, and he came to visit us. And he says now, like, he was just so horrified walking into the hotel room and seeing the situation, but he just didn't know what he could do, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, I find all of this stuff is like, all of the feelings around this is like much closer to the surface for me now, because I have my own kids.
Yeah.
So when I think about that, it's actually heartbreaking.
Oh, God. And what do you think it stemmed from?
Well, her own parents were alcoholics.
Okay.
And my granny, amazing woman, she's dead now. They're both dead now, both my grandparents. My granny was incredible. She was in recovery for something like 40 years when she died. She was like extremely successful in her recovery, but never lost sight of the fact that she was an addict, which I think is crucial to successful recovery. There's a conversation about whether addiction is genetic or whether it's like an environmental learned behavior, but certainly I think that contributed to it. I think she had a rough hand dealt to her. You know, she just did.
Yeah. And when you went to live with your aunt and uncle in Chicago, was that a hard transition for you? Because I feel like when you speak about your mom, like you've so much love for her. So Did you really feel did you feel like you were kind of taken from her?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. It was extremely difficult. Like for years, I would be going to bed. And I know it was years because I can think of the different houses that I did it in. And I would be looking out and, you know, like starlight, starbright, first star I see tonight, I wish I'm white. I have this wish I wish tonight. And every night it was that I wished that I could be back with her. It broke my heart. We had such an unhealthy, toxic relationship for a 7-year-old and her mother to have. I was certainly, like, I was pouring drink down the toilet. I was lying for her. I was, you know, it was... The roles were reversed in a major way, but we were obsessed with each other, you know? So it was really difficult, really difficult. And then also you're just going from one parenting style to another, you know? So my parents were so, when I say my parents, I mean my aunt and uncle who adopted me, like they were so young. They were 25 and 26. They were overnight parents. They obviously, I mean, no one has money when you're that age. So like they didn't have very much money and they all of a sudden had to pay for two kids. They wanted to do everything right. And so they were super, super strict because that was what they thought was the best thing they could do for us. But that was really hard to go from, you know, my mom was like super affectionate, really like, you know, demonstrative and tactile. They weren't, which is totally understandable. We were two kids who up until, you know, a few months previously had lived across the world, you know? So all of those changes were difficult to manage as well, aside from the actual loss of being with her.
Yeah. Like even when you're speaking about looking out the window and saying that little, oh God, I feel like I kind of understand what you're saying about missing your mom because my parents were split up and it's obviously not the same, but there was joint custody. So there was, you know, oh my God, sorry.
No.
There was times when like I felt a million miles from my mom.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't the time where you had phones or...
No.
You know, and I feel like I totally understand what you're saying about looking out a window and kind of wondering. So, like, what exactly... what was it that you missed? Was it, like, the smell of your mom or, like, her touch or...
Oh, it was everything. I mean, it was everything. Now I'm gone. It was everything, you know. It was just... Honestly, this is so hard to say, but it was feeling just really loved. Like I really felt so loved by her. I never doubted that. Even in everything that was going on, like even when things were really bad and they were, and you know, even on nights when we were in the pub and the manager had to call someone to come and get us, like I knew she loved us. I was never at that stage. I was never angry with her. That's not true because I was, because I can remember being so frustrated. I can remember standing in the kitchen in the apartment in America, pouring a bottle of vodka down the sink while she looked at me like kind of, she was like laughing. She was embarrassed. I could see it. And I was mad at her, but I also just felt sorry for her because she never made me doubt her love ever. Like, I never doubted that. So I think that's what I miss, just that feeling of security and, you know, that even though we weren't always super safe, I always felt loved. And I feel like that's kind of harsh on my parents, and I don't mean it to be. Like, they obviously did their absolute best, but it was just a different situation. And like, there is no two ways about it. Like, your mother, who you spend the first 7 years of your life with, I mean, all of psychology says that that's, you know, so formative and so important and such a valuable bond. So of course I was devastated and I was grieving, you know, really. I think is what it was.
Yeah. And like, just, you know, what I was saying there, like, I never had to worry about my mum's safety. Like, I knew where she was. And yeah, I don't really normally talk about stuff like that, but it's hard as a child, I think, to be apart from your primary carer.
Yeah. It's attachment theory. Like, you know, if you read about, you know, monkeys, you'll read that they also find it very hard to be apart from their primary carer. It's primal, you know. There's no two ways about it. Whether you're apart for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or indefinitely, as it was for me, you know, it's huge.
And did you ever see your mum during that time?
Yeah. So initially we saw her a bit. Like, we saw her initially, the visits were supervised, which was just so weird. Like, you know, we had this like random stranger, as far as I was concerned, a social worker with us. And that was weird. And then eventually she got visits that weren't supervised. But then they were also weird. Like, I remember just feeling just like, ugh, like, this isn't us. Like, this isn't normal. I remember one time she took us to the cinema and it was to go and see a film. I think it might have been called Dad. And I think Macaulay Culkin was in it. And I can't remember who his dad was. I'm going to Google this after and I'll tell you. But it was a film about a kid whose dad was like a mess, basically. And she was bawling, crying through the whole thing. And at the end, she said, like, you know, she was like, I'm so sorry. And she said sorry like a billion times. I'm so sorry that I can't, you know, be with you all the time. She just couldn't. I mean, that's the reality. And then it kind of fell off and we wouldn't see her for months and months and months, sometimes years, if she was having a bad patch. And then she'd have a good patch and we would see her regularly. My aunt and my adoptive mom, my mom, you know, she worked so hard to make sure that if we could see her, we saw her. Like, for example, my mom worked in a cafe in the town that we lived in at one stage, and my adoptive mom, my aunt, would bring us every week so that we could see her while she was working. Like, you know, she worked really hard to kind of try and maintain that. So yeah. And then,
and how would you feel when you'd see her working there?
Like, it was just weird. I mean, over time the bond lessened. Like, there was still that primal connection, but like, you know, she let me down a lot. She hurt me a lot over those years. Like, you know, she would say horrible things if she was feeling defensive, or, you know, she would not show up for ages and then suddenly, you know, call and it would be the wrong time. Like, I remember one day she called and I had literally just gotten home. A friend of mine in school, her mom had just died. And I was at this funeral that day, just being like, I don't even know where my mom is. Like, I don't know where she is. I hadn't heard from her in so long. And I got home and the phone rang and it was her and she was drunk. And I remember just feeling like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I can't stay as invested in this as I am because I couldn't cope. You know, I had to detach from my own well-being. So then it became more difficult. And what ended up happening was that phone call, I think I was about 13, and then she kind of disappeared. We didn't see her for a few years. And then we actually bumped into her right before we were leaving America, just by chance on the street. And she tried to, we had had an experience in the interim where I bumped into her on the street again. And I was with like a load of boys, and it was just when I'd first started hanging out with boys, and she tried to cross the road to avoid us, but I was like super hyper, as teenage girls are, and also very excited to see her. And I ran across the road and I was like, "Hey," and she was like, "Oh, you've gained weight." And I was like, "Right. That's what you have to say to me, having not seen me in years in front of these boys who I, you know, have just met." I was so humiliated. And I think that was the first time that I didn't like immediately forgive her. I was like, okay, no, this is too much. And when I met her then, right before we left, she tried to apologize to me for it. And I said, no, I was like, it's just not okay. It's not okay. Mm. I was so humiliated. And then I didn't hear from her for 4 years. We left America, so we weren't going to bump into her on the street. And she, I think, went through one of the most difficult times in her life. She became homeless. I think she stayed around, like, we lived in a small town in the suburbs of Chicago. And I think she stayed around that small town to be near us. Mm-hmm. And then when we left, she was in the city and she was homeless. And she ended up being like violently assaulted. So she ended up using a wheelchair. She was paraplegic and had limited use of her hands. She kept drinking. And I just read the Marion Keyes book, Rachel, again. And this, what happened to her is like referred to in the book. I was amazed, because she went to a barbecue and she was like having a drink, and she mid drink. And she said it was like, the way she put it is, she said it was an alcoholic's dreams, free booze. And she said she got halfway through the drink and she just put it down and said, "Take me to the emergency room. Someone needs to take me to the hospital." And she went to the hospital and she said, "I'm an alcoholic and I'm having suicidal thoughts and I need help." And it was my 18th birthday, the day that happened. Way. Yeah. Like mad. And in the
morning, how did you find that out?
Well, what happened was, I didn't hear from her. We didn't hear from her until, so that was October. And I was told that she was in recovery right as I finished my leaving cert that June. My dad was driving me up to my friend's house to get ready to go out for the night. And he said, "Look, I have to tell you something. You know, we've known for a couple of weeks, but we wanted you to finish your exams. She's been in touch. She's not drinking. She's using a wheelchair." Although everything he was saying, he was like, "This is what she says," because unfortunately, like, she'd lied to us a lot over the years. It's part of addiction. And she's going to come over. And I was like, right, okay. I just didn't even know how to handle it. And I remember it like it's a very short car journey. Like, I lived in Knocklyon. I was going to my friend's house in Knocklyon. Like, it's not a long car journey. And I got out of the car and I was like, ah. I went into my friend's house and I was just like, And she, I mean, we were so young, but she was just like, "I don't even know why you care about her anymore." Like, she couldn't understand why I cared, because as far as she was concerned, this was someone who had like wronged me so many times. And it was true, but it's not that straightforward when it's your mother, you know. It's not. And anybody who has a complicated relationship with their mother in any kind knows that that's just not the way that it goes. So she ended up coming over some months later and we kind of met up, and our relationship was pretty complicated from then on, to be honest.
I hope you are enjoying my podcast with Louise. I am blown away by her story and her openness, and I'm just so grateful to her for coming onto the Good Glow, and I can't wait to bring you the rest of that conversation. But first, I wanted to take the opportunity to thank ReproMed for supporting my podcast this season. A fertility journey is so personal, and ReproMed pride themselves in taking compassionate interest in your care. Having spent time with the team, I know that they will provide you with everything you need to know about treatment options in a safe, supportive, and honest environment. ReproMed.ie is packed full of information on IVF, egg donation, fertility preservation, and so much more. Visit ReproMed.ie for more.
It was kind of like we weren't mother and daughter anymore. I mean, obviously, biologically, we were, and there was still that kind of, as I say, primal connection. But like, you know, there was no blueprint for the kind of relationship that we were supposed to have. We lived in different countries. It wasn't like we could spend a lot of time together to kind of get to know each other again. I felt extremely conflicted. I was like, obviously delighted. I remember just like when I met her the first time after that long period of time, like looking at her hands and looking at my hands and being like, we have the same hands, like just that kind of thing, because it was such a kind of key phase. It was like, you know, my whole teens really that I barely saw her. So, you know, I was grateful that she was back. I was grateful that she was doing well, but I also just felt like, I don't really know you.
Yeah. And where did she stay?
So in America, she ended up getting, an amazing kind of living situation. She lived in a kind of assisted living building. So she had an apartment in a place, mostly like older people lived there. But then also people like her who needed a little bit of extra help. And it was like, oh my God, when she was like, she's dead now. And when she was dying, I went to her apartment for the first time and I was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? She had this like spectacular view of Chicago, like with walking distance to the Hancock building, like amazing apartment and floor to ceiling windows. I was like, are you kidding me? But you know, I think she was quite lonely because, well, I know she was actually, she put on a brave face, but it was really only when she was dying that, and I was over there with her, that I saw that like her life was really small. She worked really hard. She got a PhD. Like she did loads of stuff. She volunteered for like, a rape crisis center over there. You know, I think she was a really important and kind part of her community and her building and stuff. But like, I think she was pretty lonely. She couldn't come home because she couldn't have afforded to live here. Her setup over there was too good, given the fact that she had such an intense disability. You know, she couldn't leave the structure that she had. And
so when you say that you were reunited with her, it was in Chicago that you were reunited with her?
No, initially it was here. And then she would come over kind of every couple of years. And she, over those years, like we had like email communication and like sometimes I would feel the first visit, like we had a good visit and then she left and then I felt angry, really angry. And then she came back the next time and I like shouted at her basically for an hour and she took it, you know, and she was like, okay. And she had apologized. I mean, I don't know what I wanted her to do. She couldn't take it back, you know? And she kind of said, what do you want? And I was like, well, I want a relationship, but I don't know how to do that. And I think neither of us knew how to do that. So she would come and visit and I would leave it until she'd come for like 6 weeks and I'd meet her like 2 days before she left. And I'd make Gordon, my now husband, come with me because he's like amazing in social situations. He's like such a good social lubricant. He just, you know, he can chat to anyone. So I would just like not say that much. And then we'd leave and I'd be like, oh, well, that wasn't that bad. But then she'd be gone. So it was this kind of cycle. I just didn't know how to manage it really. And then the most time I spent with her then was when she got sick. She got sick in December of 2015. We found out she was in hospital. She had lung cancer. And initially I remember I was kind of like blasé about it. And then after I think like 2 days, I was like, oh, actually, I just have to go there. Like, and so I booked a flight the next day and we went.
Louise, when you said that, you know, that day at the barbecue that she went to hospital and said, I'm an alcoholic, was she sober then up until, you know, forevermore?
She was. And she even like, she went into treatment. I love this story about her. She went into treatment and she was like, no, this isn't going to work. She's like, this place is too nice. She said, "I this isn't going to work for me." And there was another, she heard about another tougher treatment center and she went to them and they were like, we don't have any room for you. And she was like, right, well, I'm just going to come here every day until you have room for me. She said, because it's not going to work for me in that place. She'd been in treatment so many times that she knew like, what she knew needed. She needed tough. Yeah. And eventually she got into that place. Like she was told she'd never walk again. And she did. Now she walked for like a half an hour, you know, whatever, a few minutes for a few days. But like, she got it into her head, like, I'm going to walk again. And she did. It wasn't, you know, she didn't walk forever, but she did walk again.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of person that she was. Like when she decided, you know, that she was going to do something, she was going to do it. So it's hard for me because obviously on the one side, I admired her so much. I admired the way that she turned her life around and she made it happen for herself. Mm. But on the other hand, I had all these like super complicated, like, you know, really negative feelings. And I never managed really to reconcile those, you know, and then she was gone. So it's tricky. Like,
and did you feel then when she was dying of cancer that it was almost like you were going back to your childhood in terms of the care?
I remember feeling like worried that I wouldn't be able to. I was like, oh, I don't know. Am I going to be able to like sit beside the bed and like, you know, hold her hand? And I don't know if I'm able to do that. You know, I didn't know if I had it in me. And I was really worried about that, like about the actual logistics of like caring for someone who was really sick. I mean, she was in the hospital, obviously, but, you know, as far as the hospital was concerned, I was her daughter. They didn't know about any of the complexities of the relationship. So I was worried about that, but I fell into it so quickly, so easily. Like, it just felt completely natural in the end. And I guess it was all of those years of caring for her, you know, in one sense or the other, coming back. But also I think, you know, if you're a compassionate person, you're going to do whatever needs to be done for someone if they're having a difficult time, no matter who that person is. But yeah, I'm really glad that I got to do that.
Yeah, because I suppose like both of us have had cancer, right? So we've looked it in the eye. And, you know, I've certainly thought about death throughout the last couple of years. And, you know, would you prefer to go suddenly or would you prefer to kind of have that time with your loved ones, knowing that you're going to go? So the fact that your mum had that bit of time, were you grateful for that?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think it was really important because even like my brother hadn't really, I had had contact with her, but my brother was just like, I don't need this in my life. I've moved on. And I totally respected that and at times was jealous of that position over the years. But he went over, he came over to Chicago and he did it for her. It wasn't for him. You know, he did it for her. He spent time with her and he had his chat with her and stuff. And, you know, I was writing my book at the time. And it was almost finished. And I was able to read her all of the bits that were about her. And that was so hard. Like if you've written about someone, the worst times that you've had with someone, and you have to read that aloud to them when they're literally in their deathbed, like that was fucking Jesus, sorry for the language. That was intense. But it was also really important that I got to do that because then I knew that I had her permission to kind of put this out there into the world and I wouldn't have felt right about doing it otherwise. And, you know, she got time with her siblings and, you know, nobody had a straightforward relationship with her, but we all got to leave it on a good note. You know?
That's incredible, Louise. And even the fact that you sat there and read your book to her is so brave.
I could not, you know, I couldn't not. She wanted to hear it and I needed to know that it was okay from her perspective. And, you know, when I read it to her, she said, look, that's not how I remember everything, but you know, I can't trust my memory, first of all. And second of all, this is your experience of it. Which I think is like anyone who's written a book that involves people in their lives will know that that's the struggle, is that you want to be honest. You don't want to hurt anybody, but we also have to accept that our experience of something isn't necessarily the exact truth.
Yeah.
And all you can do is give your experience with the caveat that this is my experience.
Yeah. It's such an amazing way to put it. And was she able to tell you that she loved you or she was proud of you or show you affection?
Yeah, I think I really struggled with that. And I think that one of the things that I found really hard in the last kind of years when she was sober and we were in contact was I found her saying, I'm proud of you or I love you or any of that stuff. I couldn't take it. I resented it. I just felt like, no, you don't get to be proud of me. I've done this. This is me. Like, I have managed to be okay. And I don't want to give you any of that credit. That was how I felt. But then when we were in her apartment that time, when she was like, you know, at the end of her life, oh my God, Georgie, there were like newspaper articles, pictures of me, like everywhere. And I felt so bad. I felt so sad that I hadn't managed to like build the bridge, you know? I had this picture of her life that I just hadn't had before. Seeing where she lived, like seeing, you know, what a part of her life I was, even if I hadn't let her be a part of my life, was really hard to kind of stomach, or not stomach, heart, if you can heart something. It was hard to take on. I felt so sad for her, and sad for me, and sad for what we hadn't had. You know, she would have been such an amazing mother. Like, I mean, honestly, she really had it in her to be amazing. And she was amazing in loads of ways, but she couldn't do it properly. And then when she kind of could, I couldn't take it. You know, that was just the reality. And I have to make peace with that, you know, because I'm not like mad at myself because I couldn't, I did the best I could. You know, it was such a complicated situation and nothing about it was straightforward. And I did everything that I could to, you know, to give her as much as I could, because I didn't want to give anything. You know, really my instinct was, I don't want to be in touch. I don't want any of this. I'm fine, actually. And I don't need to invite this into my life. But I knew it was important for her. So I gave her what I could, which wasn't very much, but, you know, I gave her everything I could. So I forgive myself for that, you know. Mm.
And I'm sure like what you gave her to her was, you gave her everything at the end, you know, that's probably all she ever wanted. And is there a possession of her? Is there something that you have?
Yeah, I have. She gave me all her jewelry. So I have like her engagement ring and her wedding ring and all that stuff. So she didn't really have much, to be honest, in the end. Like, I mean, she had stuff, but like nothing, you know, all our stuff was lost. Like, I don't know what happened to all the stuff that we like shipped to Chicago or like put in storage. Like all my childhood stuff was gone, basically. I had some stuff, but like not a lot.
But she managed to keep her engagement ring the whole time.
She had her jewelry, yeah. Yeah, which is pretty amazing when you consider, like, I mean, she was literally homeless on the streets of Chicago in the winter, which is like, you know, again, if you've seen Eeyore, you'll know it's very snowy in the winter in Chicago. Mm. And, you know, she was not with the best people. And, you know, the fact that she managed to kind of keep that is pretty impressive. But yeah, I think, you know, as I get more distance from it, you know, from her life, I suppose I'm finding more and more peace with it all. Like, it's not, you know, it was pretty tough initially. But, it, you know, like everything, it gets easier, it gets better.
You speak so openly about it. I have huge admiration for you for just putting that out there, because I imagine that that's very difficult for you. Would you find after speaking about her that you feel a certain way for the rest of the day, or have you?
I don't know. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Kind of hadn't really planned for this. It's just happened. Yeah, no, I think she'll be with me now, definitely for the rest of the day. You know, I think one of the reasons that it's important for me to talk about this situation and about her specifically is that addiction is everywhere. Everywhere. Every family has it. Everyone knows someone. And humanizing it is just so crucial. Like, you know, my mom was not a bad person. Like, you know, there are people who would look at that and be like, oh my God, she abandoned her children. She obviously didn't care about them. You know, blah, 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 blah. No, it's not like that. She cared enough about us to let us go. And she knew that she couldn't do it right because she was an addict. And you know, part of addiction is not being able to make good decisions. And actually the best decision she ever made was to say, you will have a better life away from me. I know that broke her heart. Like, I know it. And, you know, at the end of the day, she was a human being and she was flawed as we all are. And her flaw, unfortunately, was one that was absolutely seismic. Mm. Flaw even seems like the wrong word to use to describe it. You know, she had a condition and whatever you want to call it, disease, you know, whatever side of that debate you're on. She did the best she could in the situation she was in. And any one of us, every one of us should count ourselves lucky that we aren't an addict. Like, you know, when I started drinking, obviously I was a little bit worried about it. Like, what's going to, you know, am I going to have this in me? I don't have it in me. And that's not because I've made a decision or I'm better or worse than anyone else. It's just not in me. And thank God for that. You know, thank God. It's not something that you can control. So, you know, one of the reasons I like to talk about it is because I want people to understand that, like, standing in judgment of people who live in addiction is just like such a ridiculous position to stand in. Like, you are so lucky there, but for the grace of God, go I. Like, it could be any of us. And, you know, people who are addicted should be given the best and the most compassion. They should be embraced. They should be offered treatment. They should be given every opportunity to get better, because usually they're people who are deeply, profoundly traumatized. And instead, what happens is people look down their nose at them, people write them off, they're sent to prison, they're not offered the treatment that they require. And that's just it for them. And it's just not good enough, you know? Mm. So that's why I think it's important to talk about.
I've always thought that you use your voice for good. And it's just been such an honor to actually speak to you face to face and hear this story. And I know that you're going to continue to use your voice for good on your new podcast. So tell us about that and what sort of, so when I started the Good Glow, my intention was to help people, right? So I wanted people to see that, you know, the worst things imaginable can happen to you, but it doesn't mean it's the end. Yeah. And I think that's why my podcast is a success, because my intention was not to start a podcast, you know, to start a business, blah, 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 blah. Like, it was just genuinely to help people. So I feel like you'll be putting similar energy into your podcast.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I couldn't not, I miss it so much. I miss talking to people in this way so much. Like, I can't even explain it. I am so excited to get the first episode going and to be doing that every week, because I feel such a connection to the community of people who listen to me that, like, I miss them. And every week something happens that I'm like, oh, I wish I could talk to them about that. You know, that's how I feel about it. It's a compulsion. Like, it's not a business decision at all. So the podcast is called Catch Up with Louise McSharry. And initially it's going to be one episode a week. I'm hoping I can do more down the line. And the way that it's going to work is it's going to catch you up on the news of the week. It's going to catch you up on the entertainment news of the week, because I have such a passion for those crazy celebs and everything they get up to.
And the Real Housewives.
Oh my God. Yes, obviously. Definitely going to be Housewives chat. And then also there's going to be an interview in every episode, just a short one. Because I honestly just feel like so many people like you are doing amazing kind of slightly long form interviews with people. I was like, I got to let those people do that. So a short interview with someone who's relevant to kind of the news of the week or something that's happening. So it could be Marion Keyes talking about her new book, or it could be someone talking about their experience of living in direct provision. You know, it could be anything. So I'm hoping that what I'll get to do is kind of highlight the stories that are important to people that aren't being heard elsewhere or that aren't being heard in this way. And I'm really excited about it. I don't know if you felt this, but like the freedom of it is spectacular. Like, you know, knowing that you can just do what feels right for you and you know, you can take it. For me, I can take an editorial line if I want to. I haven't been able to do that for the last 11 years. Yeah. You know, I had to be quiet during 2 referenda that I was extremely passionate about. That was very difficult. Now I can say whatever I want. So not that I'll be saying anything dramatically different, but the possibility is there.
So your podcast is out this coming Friday, the 25th. I cannot wait to tune in. And just for anyone listening, it really helps new podcasts when you subscribe. So I'll leave a little link to your podcast in the episode show notes for this podcast and people can click in and subscribe. Louise, last question. What's the joy button for you?
Oh God, that's such a hard question. It's so many different things. I think it's my kids, and like, I would never have thought I'd be someone who would say that. But honestly, when I think about the purest, simplest joy, it's them. And particularly now, like, my son Sam is 5, Ted is about to turn 3, and they're really starting to kind of make each other laugh. And that is just like beautiful. You know, when I see the two of them making each other laugh, it's just so pure and so gorgeous. And I always just feel, obviously in the context of the conversation that we've just had, I feel every time I just feel so grateful that I'm well enough to take care of them and give them a good life. And, you know, there's real joy in that.
Wow, that was incredible. Thank you for that lovely answer. And also the reminder that it's just, it's simple, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. Like, I mean, there's loads of other stuff. Like the housewives bring me joy, definitely. Makeup, I love makeup so much. Like my friends, obviously, I love nothing more as well. Can I just say, when I'm like driving away from my parents' house, leaving my children for 48 hours, that is also a big moment of joy. I'm not going to pretend like that's not, it is. All of that stuff. But yeah, it's at the end of the day, it's the little things. I mean, you have to take joy from them because they're there every day if you're lucky.
Oh, thank you so much for your time today, Louise.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me. Thank you for reaching out when you did in the way that you did. And, you know, for clearly and genuinely, you know, wishing me well. I so appreciate it.
I think it was meant to be, this conversation today. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Good Glow podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please make sure to subscribe and check out Louise's podcast coming your way this Friday. As I said at the start of the podcast, we'll be in the National Concert Hall on May 30th. Please make sure to join us for a night full of joy, fun, laughter, music. We're going to have interviews and talks, and it's going to be a night to remember. So nch.ie for tickets, and I'll see you next week.